This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Last Train to Istanbul by Ayşe Kulin. Translated by John W. Baker. Performed by Sanjeev Javeri.
Ankara, 1941. Even though, when leaving that morning, Majid had warned Sabiha that he would be late coming home, his good manners made him uneasy when he realized it was already past 8 o'clock. He excused himself from the meeting room, went to his office, and dialed home on the black telephone with its noisy dial. "We're having a meeting again this evening. Please don't wait for me for dinner," he said.
"Not again," said his wife exasperatedly. "For nearly 3 weeks we haven't been able to have dinner together. Really, darling, hasn't anyone there got a wife or children waiting at home?"
"For God's sake, what are you going on about? The Bulgarian army is on our doorstep and you are talking about dinner." "How typical of women," he said, putting the phone down. His wife was just like his mother. The running of the house, the children's eating in bedtime, the whole family gathering around for dinner. These things were top priority for organized housewives. Atatürk's attempt to turn them into women of the world was in vain, Majid thought. Obviously, our women are only good at being mothers or housewives. And he was even beginning to have second thoughts about that. Hadn't Sabiha abandoned her motherly duties and left their daughter's upbringing to a nanny? Deep down, Majid was certainly beginning to find his wife's behavior odd. At first he was angry, thinking maybe her distant attitude was a silent protest against his endless meetings that lasted into the early hours. What right did she have to get angry about his long hours? After all, was he responsible for the war? Was he to blame for these late nights? What if Turkey actually found itself fighting in the war? If that were to happen, which woman in their circle would even catch a glimpse of her husband's face? But Majid knew in his heart Sabiha's attitude wasn't due to selfishness alone. She seemed on the verge of a nervous breakdown. For some time, this young woman who liked going on picnics, watching horse races when the weather was fine, and playing cards on rainy days, didn't seem to enjoy anything anymore. He often found his wife in bed, fast asleep, when he got home. If, when he got into bed, he put his arms around her, she would turn away. On the rare occasion they managed to go to bed at the same time, she always had an excuse to go to sleep immediately. It was obvious she had a problem, but she had chosen the wrong time to have a nervous breakdown. How on earth could he find the time to care for her when he was inundated with work? Even if his meetings finished after midnight, Majid would still have to be back at the ministry by 7 the next morning. They were living in very unsettled times. Turkey had found herself between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, there was Britain, who had only her own interests at heart, insisting that Turkey should be her ally. On the other, there was Germany's threatening attitude. As if that weren't enough, Russia extended an iron hand in a velvet glove to Turkey. Their interest in Kars, Ardahan, the Bosphorus, and the Dardanelles hung over them like the sword of Damocles. If Turkey chose the losing side, Russia would make her pay dearly where the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles were concerned. This nightmare had been ongoing for 2 years. The First World War had taught President Inonu the cost of choosing the wrong side, and he had learned his lesson well. There was nothing he wouldn't give to know which side would be victorious this time, but no fortune teller could possibly predict the outcome. It was up to the Foreign Ministry and General Staff to make this prediction. Every possible contingency had been discussed, considered, and recorded during those endless meetings that dragged on into the night.
Majid was proud to be a member of the general staff. At the same time, ever since the Italians had attacked Greece, the ring of fire had been tightening, and government employees and their families were getting nervous. The capital, Ankara, was preparing for a hot summer again. In Turkey, the winters were extremely cold and snowy, and the summers were unbearably hot. It was already obvious that the approaching summer months would be hotter than hell. About a week before, the German ambassador Franz von Papen had brought a personal message from Hitler to the prime minister, and the officials had waited with bated breath for the meeting to end. Majid guessed correctly the contents of Hitler's message. On the surface, the letter was full of good wishes and intentions. It offered Turkey every kind of armament and help strengthening control of the Bosphorus and Dardanelles, and it promised not to put German soldiers on Turkish soil. However, if read between the lines, the letter implied that now was the time for Turkey to make up her mind. And if she didn't side with Germany, she would have to suffer the consequences when the war was over and decisions were made about her waterways. After the long meeting, Inonu said,
"The Germans are telling us not to try their patience, and at any time they could make a deal with Russia behind our backs."
He went on to say,
"Britain is fighting in Greece, and they've had a disaster in Libya. She is in no position to come to our aid. This is why we shouldn't risk angering the Germans. Gentlemen, we must find a way to hedge our bets."
What they were looking for was a way to play for time without saying yes or no to either side. A way of stroking their backs without aggravating them. The morning after that long night, the Prime Minister invited the British ambassador to the ministry to explain Turkey's predicament. She was heading toward the most fearful day she had encountered during the Second World War. The war was like a forest fire, spreading in all directions, and both sides had expectations of Turkey. In his office, Majid lit a cigarette, took two puffs, and stubbed it out in the crystal ashtray before returning to the meeting room. The foreign minister and the secretary general were no longer there. His assistant said,
"Majid Bey, the president has asked to see today's assessments. I have prepared the reports for you. He is waiting in his office."
Majid hurried back to his office in the section allocated to the foreign ministry of the presidential mansion. For some months now, they had been working there so that they could instantly report to and receive instructions from Inonu. Majid took files of notes that he had updated a few hours ago from his drawer, glanced through them, and dashed off. Inonu was sitting in a club chair behind a huge table. He looked naive, smaller and more irritated than usual, leafing through the papers his private secretary took from Majid. Looking at the pages, it was as if he was listening to the voices of foxes in his mind. But he didn't say anything. The other men sitting around the table were silent, too. Suddenly he asked,
"Have you listened to the radio today?"
"Yes, sir. Our colleagues have been listening to all the European stations. I gave our report to the Secretary General a short while ago. They haven't had a moment's rest, sir, yet they continue to listen to Bulgaria and are preparing reports every half hour."
"Our agents in Bulgaria are keeping us informed on a daily basis. However, it's still unknown if Hitler is going to move south or move north to attack the Russians, sir,"
another young official said. The young man left the room and Majid stayed behind.
"Thanks to you,"
the foreign minister said.
"We have been able to take every precaution to make sure the fire doesn't spread to us. Rest assured, you can now go to Yalova with a clear conscience. We'll keep you informed of developments every minute."
Majid heard Inonu mutter,
"I wish I knew what direction the Germans will go. Ah, if only I knew.
The Germans had reached an agreement with Bulgaria, so the Germans had become Turkey's neighbors. Inonu was terrified, not knowing Hitler's next move. Hitler's modern armaments and powerful army were just across the border. He might want to move in on Egypt through Turkey. Or he could move toward the Caucasus. No one, not even his immediate staff, knew what the next target was, so Turkey had to be prepared for every eventuality. The worst scenario would be for the Germans to reach an agreement with Russia. That would spell disaster for Turkey. Majid waited for the men to finish reading the reports and then returned to the meeting room with the Secretary General. There was another long meeting, with more reports to be read, assessed, and put together before they could be presented to Inonu. Hours later, as he was walking home alone, Majid worried. The government was paying a high price in order to avoid this fire spreading throughout the world. At home, all the women, as if in a chorus, were complaining about the high price of everything. If civil servants and their families in Ankara were distressed, who knew how the poor people of Anatolia felt? In an effort to protect civil servants, the state was selling state products, textiles, shoes, and sugar, at considerably reduced prices. Furthermore, to prevent the black market and hoarding, it applied a rationing system, which meant that everybody's identity card was covered in stamps. Despite these precautions, the black market thrived. Unscrupulous people looking for a big chance became wealthy selling goods off the back of a truck. Most people were angry, but resigned. They couldn't find or afford basic supplies and had only bread and cereal to eat. The president thought his prime concern, a matter of life and death, was to prevent his country from going to war. Approaching him with the people's complaints was pointless. For a man like him, who had already personally experienced the hell of war, anything besides this was of secondary importance. Majid was exhausted. It was almost certain that Inonu would go to Yalova the following day, which meant that possibly, probably, there would be no late meetings next week. He might be able to go home earlier and thus temporarily avoid Sabiha's reproaches.
Von Spade. 2 diamonds. Pass.
Pass. Sorry. 4 spades.
The young women looked up from their cards across the table at Sabiha. She blushed, looking thin and delicate in her pale mauve suit.
You are very absent-minded today, said Humaira. What's wrong with you, dear?
Nothing. I couldn't sleep last night. I can't concentrate. Couldn't Nesrin take my place?
Absolutely not. Let's have some tea. That will sort you out.
Humaira, I have to leave before 5 today anyway.
Why?
I've got to pick Ulya up from Marga at her ballet class.
Doesn't the nanny do that?
She has something else to do today.
Oh, for God's sake, what else does a nanny have to do?
She wants to do some shopping before she goes back to England at the end of the month.
I didn't know she was leaving, Sabiha. Why?
Well, Julia has grown up. She is a big girl now. She no longer needs a nanny to fuss over her.
But I thought she was teaching Julia English, too.
She has learned enough. Her father wants her to be able to stand on her own 2 feet now and be more independent.
The ladies all put down their cards and got up from the card table. Sabiha walked toward the room where tea was being served. She wanted neither tea nor any of the pastries on the table. She only wished she could go outside for a breath of fresh air. But she took a cup of tea and sipped it, hoping to avoid further questions. The other women followed Sabiha to the tea table, swaying rhythmically to the music on the radio. Suddenly, the music stopped and an announcer's urgent voice was heard.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program to bring you some important information regarding this morning's State Committee meeting with the Prime Minister.
The ladies immediately changed direction from the tea table to the radio.
Shh, shh, listen, said Belkis.
Sabiha, too, walked toward the radio, her cup and saucer in her hand. Her hand shook as she listened to the grim news. The troops had retreated in Thrace behind the Chatalja line and were apparently digging in. The government was ordering all civilians in Istanbul to build shelters in their basements. Furthermore, those who had homes in Anatolia were being offered free transport there and could bring up to 50 kilos of luggage per family.
My God, what somber news. For God's sake, Humera, turn that radio off, said Nesrin.
No, please don't. There may be news about France, Sabiha said. I wonder what...
Nesrin interrupted.
So what about France? Who cares?
Sabiha looked at her in dismay, putting her cup and saucer on the table.
You should have some fruitcake. You like that,
offered Humera. Sabiha declined her offer, saying,
I must have caught a chill at the races last weekend. I feel nauseous, darling. I have no appetite at all.
Did you hear that they are evacuating Edirne?
Belkis continued.
In other words, war is on our doorstep.
My husband will be totally unbearable, said Nejla bluntly. He barely answers yes or no these days as it is. Can you imagine what he'll be like if we go to war?
Sabiha felt completely suffocated by her friend's conversation. While they were occupied with their tea and cake, she made her apologies to Humera and quickly left the house. The heady scent of lilac and wisteria filled the Ankara air. The beautiful wisteria tumbling over the garden walls, hanging like bunches of grapes, seemed almost to accentuate her gloomy mood. Her pale mauve suit was the only thing that harmonized with the surroundings. A thousand and one things were going through her mind as she walked home to Kavak Ludere. She bumped into an old man, and as she was apologizing, she tripped on a stone and almost fell over. Sabiha was very unhappy. She was unable to devote any attention to either her daughter or her husband, and everything was beginning to fall apart. She was gradually distancing herself from those around her. From the beginning, her daughter had been a disappointment as she had expected a son. Her husband was only interested in his work. Her parents were perpetually ill, and she had begun to have less and less in common with her friends. It was almost as if she were breaking away from life itself. Majid was so busy that it seemed, to her at least, that he didn't even notice the change in his wife. This made it easier for her to keep to herself. As for her friends, lately she had started making up excuses so as not to attend their various get-togethers. The nanny wasn't doing any shopping today, and she didn't have to collect Julia from Madame Marga's ballet school. What was true was that the nanny was indeed returning to England. Majid wanted it that way. He believed Julia no longer needed a nanny, now that she was going to school, and that Sabiha should devote more time to their daughter herself. Sabiha was aware that she hadn't been in control of her life for some time now. This damned war was running her life. What's more, it wasn't even in her own country. Nothing could be found in the shops, and no one could travel. War was the only topic of conversation. Majid was like a prisoner of war. It was as if he was a soldier himself. They had been such a happy couple, had had so much fun together once upon a time. Before her sister went away, before the war. Sabia missed those long-gone days. On the other hand, she couldn't help thanking her lucky stars whenever she read the newspapers or listened to the radio. At least in Ankara, their lives were secure. No policeman or soldier was knocking on their door at some ungodly hour. There weren't people around wearing yellow badges on their chests like branded asses. Branded asses? Whose words were those? Nejla was the only one who would make such crude remarks. Suddenly, Sabiha remembered. 2 weeks ago during a bridge party, Nejla, in one of her callous moods, had said,
"The poor Jews have been made to wear yellow badges on their clothes, just like branded asses."
"What on earth are you saying?" Sabiha screamed. "How can you possibly compare people to asses? You called yourself a diplomat's wife. I wonder if you can actually hear yourself." Nejla, almost in tears, had asked her friends,
"What's got into her? Why is she screaming at me like that?"
"This war has got to all us girls,"
their hostess had said, trying to diffuse the situation.
"These days the slightest spark causes an explosion. Come on, let's get on with the game. Whose turn was it?"
Sabiha now felt embarrassed remembering her outburst. She certainly was in a terrible mood. It was the same thing every day when she read the news in the papers. The Nazis storming over Europe, the fleeing emigrants, France. Oh! Sabiha reached out to touch one of the wisteria blooms on a wall, but just as she was about to pick it, she withdrew her hand. She couldn't bring herself to snap off the flower. Suddenly, she felt a lump in her throat, and as she turned toward the street, tears streamed down her face. As night descended, she gasped for breath. The sad day would turn into yet another sad night. Majid was probably going to come home late. Julia would have her endless whens, whys, and wheres throughout the meal. The nanny would sit across the table, undoubtedly talking about the war. Ankara, which was so full of happy memories, only represented sadness now. Not just sadness, but monotony, dreariness as well. Life was just gray. Majid opened the front door as quietly as possible. He didn't want to disturb his wife if she was sleeping. He tiptoed into the bedroom and could see by the pale pink light of the bedside lamp that she was awake. She lay with her hair spread across the pillow, looking at her husband through puffy red eyes.
"What's wrong? Why have you been crying?" asked Majid.
Sabiha sat bolt upright in bed.
"I'm on edge. This letter arrived by the evening delivery. The postman left it on the doormat. I found it as I was taking out the garbage. Here, read it."
"Who's it from? Your mother? Is your father ill again?"
"It's not from Istanbul, Majid. The letter is from Selva."
"Really?"
"Majid, I'm scared. We've got to do something. We must get her here. This cannot go on. Sooner or later, my mother will hear what's happening in France, and I swear it will give her a heart attack."
Majid took the letter and tried to read it by the dim light.
"Selva would never agree to come here, leaving Rafo behind," he said. "Rafo wouldn't agree to come back."
"But this can't go on. Selva has got to consider our mother. I've asked the telephone exchange to connect me to her. God knows how long it will take. Maybe by the morning or sometime tomorrow."
"You've done what, Sabiha? How many times have I told you not to call Selva from the house?"
"Well, I certainly couldn't go to someone else's house at this hour of the night. I have to speak to my sister. I have to persuade her before it is too late."
"I'm going to cancel the call,"
said Majid, rushing to the telephone.
"How can you do that? She's my sister. Don't you understand?"
Majid returned to the room. "Sabiha,
I am working for the foreign ministry. The Germans are at our borders. War is on our doorstep, and you are booking a call to a Jew in France? You're asking for trouble.
I'm fed up with your foreign ministry. I'm really fed up. I'm always imagining that I'm being followed by spies.
It's almost the school holidays. Then you and Julia can go to your parents in Istanbul. I just wonder if your father will be as understanding as I am on the subject of your sister. Sabia heard her husband walk to the end of the hall, dial the operator, cancel the call, and then go to the living room. Sabia started to cry again, very quietly. Majid went out onto the balcony. He lit a cigarette and looked at the midnight blue horizon far, far away. Majid was happy with the cool Ankara nights. But tonight, for the first time, he felt cold and uncomfortable. He tried to warm his arms by rubbing them with his hands. It wasn't just the weather that made him feel cold. They were living through days that, for those who understood what was going on, were dangerous enough to make one's hair stand on end. Neither the man in the street nor his capricious wife whimpering indoors was aware just how close they were to the brink. They simply switched on the radio, listened to the news, then complained about the black market and how expensive everything was before pulling up a blanket and drifting off to sleep. They weren't aware of anything. No one knew the extent of the disaster Turkey would face if she was dragged into the war by either side. How could anyone know the knife edge that İnönü and his colleagues trod? The government was trying its best not to alarm the public or cause a panic. Majid wondered whether it was better to disclose the truth so everybody could face the facts, or take on the role of a protective father, shielding the children from bad news. Not long ago, just a few months in fact, the country had been sucked into the whirlpool of war. War. It was worse than that. It was a cesspit, a filthy cesspit. Majid threw his cigarette butt in anger. It fell somewhere in the pitch darkness without a glimmer of light. He remembered the stories his war hero father told about this darkness and the cigarette lights at night. 1, 2, 3 lights, 5 lights, 10 lights. Bodies without arms or legs, corpses without heads. People miserable, hungry, covered in lice like wounded, skinny animals. Starving, abandoned children. Women who'd lost their humanity. Men who had no money, no home, and no hope. He vaguely remembered his father in that state appearing at the garden gate, all skin and bones, covered in lice, his uniform in rags. He had staggered toward the edge of the pool and collapsed. This was a memory imprinted in Majid's mind, but he wasn't sure if he had actually witnessed it or was told about it later. What he did remember was that the gardener hadn't recognized his master and thought he was a beggar. It took some time before they realized who the man was. The tall, strong, sociable Ruhibe had become a cadaver, a spiritless skeleton dragging one leg, without the usual gleam in his eye. Such was war. Majid was certain that victory was to be won around the table, not on the battlefield. He was working so hard to save the people of his nation from that dreadful fate again, but how could he explain that to his sobbing wife? Slumping into a straw armchair and drifting into his memories, he realized he had gotten used to the coolness on the balcony. Majid had contributed a lot toward the signing of the agreement with England and France in 1939. According to that agreement, the French and the British would provide the Turkish army with its vital needs. In return, Turkey was to sell the chrome she produced to France throughout the war. The Turkish foreign minister himself had traveled to France with Majid to sign the agreement. They had gone to Paris with great expectations. But unfortunately, the end result didn't meet their hopes.
France desperately needed the money they'd make selling the Turkish chrome. But despite Menemenceolu's insistence on supplying the chrome for the duration of the war, France would only sign for 2 years. Then Britain drastically reduced the quantity of arms, tanks, and anti-aircraft guns it was willing to supply to Turkey. The Turkish army needed 11 million bullets and 6,500 machine guns. The British were only prepared to supply 2 million bullets and 200 machine guns. With these pitiful supplies, how on earth could Turkey be expected to stop the Germans in the Balkans? One could understand a person fighting with his bare hands to save his own country, but to fight for the British, who had stirred up the Arabs against the Turks in the First World War, when they had set their eyes on Mosul and Kirkuk, was too much to expect. At the same time, other European countries, for their own reasons, had supported various Middle Eastern tribes who were seeking independence. Had it been left to Majid, he would not have lifted a finger for any of them. Let the Europeans go at each other's throats. Wasn't it enough that they were dragging each other into this war? Majid had no doubt that if for some reason Turkey was eventually forced to join the war, she would have to foot the bill for the ambitions of the great powers. During a meal on the train on the way back from Paris, Majid learned that the foreign minister was concerned about another thing. He addressed the delegation.
"Gentlemen, as I see it, the British haven't got enough weapons and the French have none. They aren't able to deliver the goods because they have bad intentions. It is simply impossible. I became fully aware of this situation during our talks in Paris. There are all sorts of questions in my mind. I have doubts about their eventual victory. I wonder if we are backing the wrong horse, signing these agreements that will make us their allies."
After a year of endless discussions, who would win the war? Which side should Turkey support? It had been decided that Turkey should support the French and British. Now in Paris, they had found out about France's lack of weapons. Gradually, they had begun to realize that they may have chosen the wrong partner. Although they didn't return to Ankara empty-handed, they were very disappointed that less than half their expectations had been met. At the end of the talks, on the evening of their last day in Paris, Majid had managed to keep a promise he had made to Sabiha to meet up with Selva. He had told his friends that he had to see a relative who lived in Paris, and they were courteous enough not to ask questions. Majid chose to meet Selva at the Café de Flore, because it was tucked away out of sight. Selva arrived with an armful of gifts for her mother, sister, and niece. She hugged Majid tightly and kissed him on both cheeks. It was obvious how happy she was to see someone from home. She asked about everyone in great detail. Was Sabiha still tying Julia's hair with huge satin ribbons? Had they been inviting the same old friends to their Friday soirees? Who was Sabiha's bridge partner? Did her mother close down the summer house at the end of the season or when it got cooler? She even asked about her father, who was so disappointed in her. Majid looked at all the presents his sister-in-law had piled on a chair. With an embarrassed look on his face, he said, "I really can't take all this back with me, Selva. I only have a small suitcase."
"Please, Majid, don't deny me the pleasure of sending a few things to my family. I might not get another opportunity. I can duck out and get another little bag from Lafayette."
"No, for God's sake, don't.
What will my colleagues think? We are here on official business. They'll say I have done so much shopping for myself and my family that I had to buy an additional suitcase to carry everything." "At least take the lavender perfumes I got for my mother and sister. There are also some chocolates for Julia."
"I wish you hadn't gone to all this trouble. You must have spent quite a bit of money. What a shame.
After exchanging news, suddenly there was a lull in the conversation. It was only then that Majid noticed the dark circles under Selva's eyes. In the evening sun, he realized how pale and haggard she looked. She was still wearing the green raincoat that Majid knew so well, which indicated that she couldn't afford a new one here in Paris. This was Fazul Reshat Pasha's daughter, who had been born with a silver spoon in her mouth. The things one does for love! Majid couldn't help wonder if Sabiha would have had the courage to act the same way if her parents hadn't approved of him. Majid wasn't sure that he wanted to know the answer. Sabiha might not have chosen to endure hardship for the sake of love. Would she have married him had he been of another religion? Been Armenian, for instance? No, not in a million years. No doubt his coming from an old, respected Istanbul family, well-educated and with a good career, contributed considerably to her choice. But why should he feel disappointed? Hadn't he made similar choices? Wasn't Sabiha a beautiful, intelligent, educated girl, well brought up in a respected family and well adjusted to boot? He remembered the sensible advice Sabiha had given to her sister in those days when Selva was head over heels in love. It had not had much effect, but that was beside the point.
"Love is like a flame. It burns itself out eventually," Sabiha had told Selva. "What will you do then, when you finally come to your senses, if you repent and wish to divorce Rafu? It won't be the same as divorcing someone else. No one will want to marry you after that. I swear you'll end up an old maid." "Because I'll be considered the leftover of a Jewish husband? Is that it?" "Don't you worry, dear sister. I am sure that if the flame burns out, as you say, our friendship will survive. We will be lovers and best friends." "What if, God forbid, something should happen to Rafu? Will you come home as the Jewish Madame Alfandari?"
"I certainly won't do that. I won't return to the house of our father, who has rejected me simply because I have fallen in love with a man who is not a Muslim. Who knows? By then, anyway, I may have children of my own, or even grandchildren."
When Sabiha realized she was getting nowhere with Selva, she tried talking to their father.
"Times have changed, father. These sorts of differences don't matter anymore. Please don't do anything you'll regret later. I beg of you, father, please be sensible. Look at Sami Pasha's daughter-in-law. She's Greek, isn't she? Then there's Vejdi Bey's wife, who is German. What about them? Plus, you were educated in Europe. You're supposed to be more open-minded."
"If she marries that man, she will no longer be a daughter of mine. She'll have to forget she was ever my daughter."
"But father, how can she possibly forget she is your daughter?"
Fazul Pasha looked far away, out the window.
"You mean was."
This dreadful situation had turned the family upside down and lasted not just a few days, weeks, or months, but years. Fazul Pasha's unsuccessful attempt at shooting himself hadn't stopped Selva. She simply waited until he was well again and then went to her lover. Then it was their mother's turn to cause havoc. She took to her bed seriously ill and needed constant care and attention. Fazul Pasha refused to leave the house. The family was so ashamed. They couldn't look any of their friends directly in the eye. The incident hadn't done the family any good, but at least now they knew who their real friends were. Now, even friends they had considered close were gossiping behind their backs, blaming Pasha because he had educated his daughters in Christian schools, as indeed many of them had. Sabiha and Selva, like most of their friends' children, were sent to the American school in Gedik Pasha for their primary education, then to the French school for their secondary education, and finally to the American college. Both sisters grew up speaking English and French fluently. Majid remembered how impressed he was, Many years ago, when he first saw his fiancée reading poems by Baudelaire and Byron, even his mother, God rest her soul, had been impressed.
"Just the sort of wife who would be right for a diplomat," she had commented.
Selva's voice brought him back to reality from where he had been lost in his thoughts.
"Will Turkey join the war then?"
"No, she won't."
"Are you sure?"
"We are doing our best to see to it that she doesn't. We certainly can't afford another war, Selva."
"Majid, there is something I need to ask."
"Please do."
"My father? Will he ever forgive me?"
"Frankly, I don't know, Selva. Your sister and I have closed this subject. We no longer talk about it."
"Really?"
"Yes. What else is there to say?"
"You really think so, Majid?"
Majid took a sip of coffee before replying. "What I think is neither here nor there. You have done what you wanted. Aren't you happy at least? Was it worth the upheaval you caused?"
"I resent your attitude, I must say. You are talking as though you had never met Rafo yourself."
"I don't see why you should resent my telling the truth. You simply refused to listen to anyone. You went ahead and burned your bridges. You hurt your father, your mother, and Sabiha. I only hope that it was worth it. We all hope you'll have no regrets."
"I love Rafo very much, Majid. I have no regrets, but I am very unhappy."
Tears were streaming down her face. Majid took her trembling hands in his. "Come on, Selva. You shouldn't be unhappy if you love him so much. Think of all you have endured to be together. You are a very strong person. You have always known what you wanted and had the courage to stick to your guns. I'm sure your father is aware of this too. He may not have forgiven you yet, but I am sure that deep down inside, he still loves you dearly."
"I miss everybody so much."
"Time is a great healer. Give this a little more time."
"I wonder how much more time,"
Selva said anxiously. Was there any? Majid thought. Time was so very precious these days, particularly the past few months, as precious as gold. Wasn't it time that the Turkish delegation had come to Paris for? President İnönü was seeking time more than anything else. Time to think, time to distract, time to avoid war. In fact, İnönü kept answering questions regarding the war by saying,
"Time will tell."
Majid now gave the same answer to his sister-in-law. "I don't know, Selva. Time will tell." He realized he was now using diplomatic tactics in his personal life. He had always thought that things could change in the blink of an eye, bringing unforeseen results. But in the present circumstances, Europe could find no solace in predictions or hope. Before leaving Selva, Majid held her hands tightly and looked into her eyes.
"Everything can change, Selva, and change rapidly. Should anything happen that puts your life in danger, you must return home immediately."
"I can't return without Rafo, Majid."
"I think you should. He's a man. He can look after himself."
"We vowed to stick together throughout our lives. He wouldn't want to go back. You know all he went through, all those insults. And I just couldn't leave him."
"Think carefully. We only have one life to live. We alone are responsible for it."
"Majid, try to understand. I am not only responsible for my own life."
"Exactly. Even at sea, women and children abandon ship first."
"You don't understand. I'm not talking about Rafo."
Majid, who had stood up to leave, sat down again.
"No,"
You don't mean...
Yes, I do.
When?
Early next year.
Why didn't you tell me before?
I had hoped you'd notice.
Looking at her more closely, Majid could indeed see that she had put on weight around the waist and that her breasts were fuller than he remembered. On the other hand, her face was drawn. He thought she must be mad to get pregnant in wartime. Rather reluctantly, Majid wished her well.
"Do you want me to tell Sabiha?" he asked.
"I have already written her, but she may not have received my letter yet. If you are going back tomorrow, you may well spread the news, but I'd rather she hear it from me first."
"Of course."
"I have also written my mother."
"Think very carefully, Selva. You now have one more reason to return to Istanbul."
"I can't raise my child without its father." "Don't worry, Majid. Rafo also believes that staying here is dangerous. He is following up a few work possibilities outside Paris, somewhere in the countryside. We may be leaving Paris within a month."
Rafo and Selva did eventually manage to leave Paris and move to Marseille. But to what use? The Nazis had cast their shadow even down there. In order to save the southern part of the country from being invaded, Marshal Pétain's newly formed government sacrificed the French Jews in order to cope with Hitler. Gradually, the French Jews, who had thought they might be able to go unnoticed by living in remote areas, began to realize they were wrong. The Germans penetrated everywhere, just like smoke. It became impossible to get away from them. Rafo had started working in Marseille with a friend of his who was a chemist. Selva's mother had sold a diamond ring at auction and managed to send the money to her younger daughter without the knowledge of her husband. Rafo invested the money in a partnership with his friend, the chemist. He and Selva lived in an attic apartment right across the street from the shop. Selva gave English and piano lessons to three young girls who were neighbors. They had managed to make a few friends, but Selva's best friend was still her sister. She wrote to Sabiha every day, giving her details of their life. Her pregnancy was going fine, no morning sickness. No financial problems, but they were living hand-to-mouth. Their only luxury was the telephone they'd installed so that the sisters could keep in touch. Nevertheless, Rafo and Selva were well aware of the net closing around them. Selva had even heard atrocious reports of men being stopped by the police and asked to drop their pants in order to check if they had been circumcised. Luckily, Rafo hadn't been subjected to this humiliation. All of their friends looked upon them as Turkish, since they always spoke Turkish to each other. Back in March, Selva had even fasted for Ramadan and had made sure everyone knew she was fasting. Despite all their efforts, she feared that sooner or later, the truth would come out. Majid knew his wife constantly worried about her sister, but there was nothing much he could do about it. These days, personal dramas were a drop in the ocean compared to those that confronted the nation. He went indoors after finishing a second cigarette. He was shivering as he walked toward the bedroom. He stopped outside and heard his wife breathing heavily. Sabiha had managed to fall asleep. He crept into the bathroom and undressed there so as not to disturb her. Then Majid got into the warm bed, but he couldn't sleep. He tossed and turned until he heard the telephone ringing. "My God," he thought, "they probably forgot to cancel the call." He rushed out of bed and, without even pausing to put on slippers, ran down the hall, reaching the phone and answering it breathlessly. "Hello."
"I'm sorry, sir. I knew I'd wake you, but..."
"Hello? Hello, who's that?"
"It's me, Tarık. Tarık Arıca."
"Oh, Tarık."
Majid took a deep breath.
"What's happened?"
I'm sorry for calling at this late hour. I hope I haven't woken the rest of the family.
Tell me, what's the matter?
Bad news, I'm afraid. I'm on duty at the office and, well, half an hour ago the Germans attacked Rhodes.
Majid slumped into the armchair.
I can't believe it, he mumbled.
I'm afraid so. The Secretary General, the Minister, and the Chief of Staff are to meet in about 20 minutes. The President has been informed.
I understand, said Majid.
I'm on my way, thank you.
He crept toward the bedroom again. Sabiha was still sound asleep. He went into the bathroom and dressed in the same clothes he had taken off earlier. When Sabiha heard Majid close the door, she sat up in bed and waited for a while in the dark. She turned on the lamp on her bedside table. Tears were running down her face onto her pink nightdress. She held up her arms to pray.
Please, God, protect my darling Selva. Save my sister from that hell. I beg of you, God.
She clasped her hands to her face and rocked in despair.
Forgive me, my little sister, she whispered. Forgive me, Selva.
Istanbul, 1933. Selva was drying her long blonde hair in the sun, combing it with an ivory comb, and at the same time shaking it, scattering a myriad of tiny drops that looked like little balls of crystal. Sabiha looked on enviously and snapped,
Don't dry your hair over here. You'll stain my dress. You must be joking. Whoever heard of water leaving stains? I assure you that water stains silk.
Selva walked away from the window and sat cross-legged on her bed, continuing to dry her hair.
You could take me with you, you know. But I don't want to.
Why?
Because you're too young, that's why. Maybe next year.
But I'm taller than you.
Sabiha looked at her sister angrily. She was going to respond, but bit her lip for a while. Knowing how proud Selva was of her long hair, Sabiha couldn't resist saying,
You know, I think it's about time you cut your hair. You'll be sweeping the floor with it soon.
Father won't let me cut it.
You're lying. You just don't want to. That's all there is to it.
Maybe so. It's so old-fashioned, Selva. It's almost down to your ankles. It's difficult to wash and difficult to dry, too. For years now, you've had that huge knot on top of your head. 2 plaited strands of hair tied into a top knot. Aren't you tired of it, for God's sake?
Nope.
Well, that's fine by me, but if you want to go to tea parties with me, you'll have to do something different with your hair. I can't have you walking beside me looking like Queen Victoria. I hope you understand that.
I do, Sabiha.
Sabiha wasn't surprised by her sister's answer. She was one of those people who never contradicted anybody, but somehow always managed to get her own way. It was impossible to argue with her, so Sabiha changed the subject. Trying necklaces on in front of the mirror, she asked her sister,
Which one do you think?
That one,
Selva suggested.
No, I think this one is better.
This will do. Can you help me with the hook, please?
She pulled up her hair and knelt down for her sister to fasten it. Selva admired her sister's choice.
You were right. It is perfect. You'll be the most beautiful girl at the party.
Sabiha looked at herself in the mirror. The 3 strands of pearls complemented her light green silk dress. Very elegant, she thought. She touched up her hair, tucking the sides behind her ears. She certainly looked good. She smiled at her reflection in the mirror. Just then her mother opened the bedroom door.
Your friends are here, dear. Hurry up and for God's sake don't be home late. You must be back before your father or there'll be trouble.
Sabiha blew her sister a kiss and followed her mother out of the room. Moments later she rushed back, hugged Selva and said,
I promise to take you with me next time,
and rushed out again. Selva listened to their footsteps down the hall, got up from the bed, plaited her hair, and walked toward the mirror,
fixing her hairpins.
"I'll never forgive you, my lord. No, no, never. I shall never forgive you, Lord Seymour. I trusted you with all my heart. You may now leave me,"
she said, pointing to the door. Hearing her daughter, her mother returned to the bedroom asking,
"What on earth are you doing, my child?"
"Oh, mother, I didn't hear you come in," she said with a laugh. "I am rehearsing the end-of-term play. I am playing Elizabeth the First."
"Who's the king?"
"There is no king, mother. When Henry the Eighth died, all hell broke loose. The play is about the rivalry between two women fighting over the throne of England. Muala is playing Mary Stuart, and Raffo is playing Lord Seymour. Of course, there are other parts too, priests and lords, etc. Please, mother, can I invite the cast for tea next week? Please don't say no.
You can invite just the girls."
"Really, mother, how can we rehearse with just the girls? Who's going to play the boys' parts?"
"Oh, dear, what will I do with your father again? You know how he feels about these things. You know what I went through to persuade him to let you go to parties."
"What do you mean? You never let me go to parties."
"But, darling, you're not even 18 yet."
"Don't fret, mother. I won't want to go to parties even when I am 18. I only say I want to go to tease my sister."
"And why on earth won't you want to go?"
"Don't you think I know why girls go to parties?"
"They go because they want to find themselves a husband."
"And where does all this come from?"
"I hear Sabiha talking to her friends about it. It seems that they are all after the same thing. They all have one thing on their mind."
"And what's wrong with that, may I ask? Of course, suitable young men with good educations are invited to those parties. They all speak several languages and behave impeccably. Besides, these parties are always held at home, where their elders can keep an eye on things."
"I know, and that's exactly what annoys me. The mothers arrange these parties so they can choose a suitable husband for their daughters."
"So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with a mother wanting her daughter to have a good marriage?"
"Well, I certainly don't want that."
"That's all right by me, then. Your father and I won't help. You can rely on the old-fashioned method like I did. Let's see how you react when the matchmaker comes knocking on our door."
"God forbid. That's not what I meant at all."
"I can hardly imagine you being happy with that."
"Never. Over my dead body."
"I didn't think so. So what are you carrying on about?"
"I don't really know. I just find it odd for eligible young men and sweet little girls to be herded together to try to... Oh, I give up. I can't explain."
"Perhaps you can explain exactly how you will find the appropriate young man to be your husband. Are they to be found in the marketplace by any chance?"
"All I know is that I will find my own husband myself. I would hate to find someone through a competition organized by keen mothers."
"That's just great. You have spoken just like the child you are. What would someone of your age know about choosing a husband? Enough of this. You had better get on with your rehearsal."
Just as her mother left the room, Selva called after her.
"Mother, wait. What about next week's rehearsal here? Would you at least allow me to ask just one, I mean just one boy who has the lead?"
"Who is the star, then?"
"Raffo. Rafael Alfandari."
"Alfandari? Is he the famous doctor's son?"
"Grandson."
"Well, what can I say?" "I suppose you can. I believe your father knows the family. He might not be against it."
Leman Hanum left the room, and Selva continued to practice her lines in front of the mirror. Later that evening, Selva was studying when her mother rushed into her room in a flurry.
"Selva, it's 5:30 and your sister isn't back yet."
"It can't be that time already. I haven't heard the clock chime yet."
Just as she said it, the cuckoo called once from the clock in the hallway, as it did every half hour.
"There you are.
said Leman Hanum.
Don't panic, Mother. She'll be here any minute.
I just hope she comes home before your father.
Selva walked to the window and looked outside.
Here she is. She's coming now.
Mother and daughter